Hi, today is August 21st, 2015. This is Tyler Gasawara, and this is Mobile Views Podcast number 128. I'm here with my good friend John Westfall. We've got kind of a mishmash of stuff today, no real theme. A couple of Google things, a couple of Android, Microsoft things, sort of, and one update to something John mentioned in podcast number 127. But in any case, the first thing I want to mention, you know, well, John and I have both been following Windows Phone since the days when it was Windows CE and Windows Mobile. And unfortunately for people who are fans of that platform, it continues to lose ground. The Verge published an article based on Gartner Group's latest Q2 2015 smartphone sales. And it is down to, what was it, 2.5%?
Yeah, it went down to 2.5. 2.8 to 2.5.
Yeah. Which doesn't sound like a lot, but a fraction
of percentage. That's like a whole seven people, Todd. You know, I'm being very mean about it, but
it's hard to say. You could be right.
I guess it would be kind of funny if Gartner really just has a list of like 45 names.
Yeah, I mean, right, it's literally a sample, right? They can't. Well, yeah, I don't know how they do it actually.
That's a good question.
Yeah, I didn't look at the methodology.
Put back on our methodologist hats at some point and see if Gartner's full of it. But anyway, assuming they are right. This is another little piece of bad news for the Windows 10 or Windows Phone 10 or Windows 10 phone for mobile enterprise.
Whatever the heck it's called.
Whatever
the branding the brand of the day is.
Yes. There should be a little app that you can go spin the wheel of Microsoft branding.
Right.
And in fact, I think someone actually wrote something like that a few years ago.
Oh, and by the way, though, not to rag on Windows Phone, which we were both big fans of at one point. But Android lost a little bit of market share. Also, the only thing I really gained was Apple's iOS iPhone
platform. Yeah, and I can only see Android as potentially staying the same or going down slightly because of some of the things that the biggest power player in Android has done. So Samsung recently released their Note 5 line, doing something that the ardent purists of Android hate. They took out removable batteries and removable expandable SD storage. Mm. And many of the power users, the Samsung Note lovers, said, you know, this is not something they're ever going to do to us because we're paying for the premium device. Right. We want a bigger device. We already don't really care too much about being slim and trim because it was the first phablet device. We know it's going to be a big device. Mm-hmm. We like having the ability to slap in a new battery halfway through the day or use SD cards to expand storage. So they're surely not going to take it away from us. But now you cannot buy a Samsung new device that has a removable SD card or battery. It's all integrated. So those purists are
like
going
an iPhone.
Yeah, they're going to have to decide, is Android really what I want to stay on? If they were staying on Android only for those features, they might decide to jump ship.
Hmm. Well, that's definitely a problem. And, you know, I've only bought one Samsung Android device. There was their original Galaxy Tab tablet, which is, I think, a 7 or 8-inch tablet, you know, kind of iPad mini size.
Yep, that's the only one I've ever owned either.
And it's a good one, you know, and it does have an SD slot, does not have a removable battery, although, you know, it's not so much of an issue with a tablet.
It is my one of my virtual picture frames at home.
Oh, neat.
Like, it was through Photos. And it's actually doing a much better job of that than the Nexus 7. I set up the Nexus 7 first gen to do that, and it powered itself off randomly. The Nexus, or the Samsung Galaxy Tab, the original, I can turn that thing on and it will run for months without me having to touch it.
Wow.
It loses time, though, oddly enough.
Really? So it doesn't sync with like NTP server or anything?
Not natively, I don't think. Hmm. I think I have to look into maybe installing something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's going to be definitely a problem for the power users, as you noted. It was one of the real big draws in general. For, you know, for a lot of people who, you know, like to take a lot of photos or carry movies when they travel, especially on a big phone like the Note, where you can pretty comfortably watch a TV show, a movie while you're in an airplane.
Yeah, I am. I'm actually really shocked that Samsung did that, but it doesn't surprise me in the terms of we've kind of had this expectation that that's what's just going to happen and you're going to deal with it if you like Samsung. But, you know, I was the first one. I remember we had discussions with some of our former MVP friends back when they first started, when the Android OEMs first started removing the batteries about 4 years ago now. Yeah. When HTC was the first one to say, oh, we're not going to do removable batteries anymore. And I, you know, I threw a big fit saying this is the worst possible thing. You know, I might as well just go for an iPhone. And then about a year later, I went for an iPhone. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Of course, you know, Samsung may say, well, the power user, it's sort of like how Microsoft treated MVPs. You know, you power users, you're such a tiny fraction of a percentage minority that we really don't care about you.
Yeah, and if you keep doing that with tiny fractions of a minority,
pretty soon it's 100%.
Yeah, you could whittle down your whole thing pretty quickly, apparently.
Well, they have lost a fraction of a percentage of market share of new smartphones purchased, so we'll see. You know, of course, that said, Apple's market share is not all that huge. And in fact, it's smaller than what Windows Phone's market share was back in the days when, you know, smartphone market share wasn't that big to begin with, but still, percentage-wise.
And Samsung, maybe sensing that they need to do something, has just announced yesterday a trial program for iPhone users only, where for $1 you can basically rent a Galaxy smartphone for a month, and then if you like it, you can buy it. But they will send you the phone, a SIM card, everything you need to get it up and running and try it out for a month.
That's pretty good.
But it's only to iPhone users. You actually have to sign up to it through Safari on an iPhone.
Yeah, and I just can't imagine somebody moving from an iPhone to an Android phone unless they had a very specific need. You know, it wouldn't be a general thing. It's like, I want that camera or I want a stylus or, you know, something very specific.
Yeah, it is very interesting. I've never seen a study that really looks at non-power users, just regular consumers, how often they jump ship.
Yeah.
But I suspect that for the majority of iPhone users I meet on a daily basis, especially in education, are just they know how to use their phone and they don't want anything different. They, you know, Apple makes little changes over time and they kind of begrudgingly say, okay, fine, I'll deal with this little refresh here and there. But Samsung and the other Android OEMs will make occasionally giant changes to their operating system, and Android makes giant changes from version to version. So I don't know how many people really are unless you've lived in that culture, I don't know how comfortable you are jumping back and forth from those cultures.
Okay, and speaking of jumping back and forth, I'm going to jump one ahead on our topic list since you're talking about Android and essentially fragmentation. So, you know, I've been using Android phones since the G1 that came out in T-Mobile and a year after an iPhone was released, so that would be the fall of 2008. I returned it in less than 2 weeks to get my money back because it was such a terrible piece of junk from a battery point of view, at least.
I just waited until, I think, March or April of that next year. Right when Android 1.5 came out, I bought a G1 used.
Yeah. And, well, you know, our friend Frank, he bought one of those giant backpack batteries for it, and that's how he got through the day on that thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to do that. But in any case, so I've been a huge anti-fan of Android fragmentation because, you know, it's very difficult to even move from Android phone to Android phone because they look completely different depending on the skinning and the version you're running, and it's just a mess. And now it turns out, as a new Moto 360 smartwatch owner, it turns out there I learned, you know, I kind of knew this going into it, having read up on it, but I got hit by Android Wear fragmentation. So Android or Google just updated Android Wear to support something that they call interactive watch faces, or what, as Apple people would say, the interactive complications. So the little tiny bits and pieces on the watch interface itself, the time interface. So for example, if there's a weather, you know, thing under your on your watch face, when it shows time, you're supposed to be able to tap it and get more weather information. And that's all good and well. So although I was able to install Android Wear 1.3 app on my Android phone, which is, you know, no problem, it turns out that the firmware on the watch side, which is needed to actually use these new interactive watch faces, is not on my Moto 360 watch. And based on past behavior of Motorola, I don't expect to see this firmware upgrade for months, maybe until next year. So,
or maybe not at all.
Or maybe not at all. That's possible. So it's kind of irritating not to be able to use a feature that's really appealing to me. They've got one new interactive watch face in particular, which has swappable modules, so you can have a little circles around the watch face that, you know, has like email count and or battery charge, and you can take them in or out depending on what you want, you know, weather, that sort of thing. So I was really looking forward to trying it, but alas, Android Wear fragmentation. Hello.
That is extremely frustrating.
Yeah.
And I know the only hope I have for you is that Android still does have a bit more of an active culture of hackers than iPhone. Yeah. So you might find firmwares for the Moto 360 that are a little bit more fresh than what Motorola would provide. Although the other day, thinking of weird firmware hacking, someone got an Apple Watch to display a custom faceplate. Oh. That was running watchOS 2. So it wasn't something official, but it looks like there may be some future to custom watch faces on the Apple Watch.
I'm sure that's coming.
I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
And I'm hopeful that you get your update, because it would drive me absolutely crazy to have one of the most, I would say, aesthetically beautiful Android Wear devices on the market today and not be able to use one of the coolest features that's just been announced for it.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm really hoping that it's, you know, available sooner rather than later. Okay, now going back up our list is an iOS thing, and that's Microsoft announced some updates for Outlook for iOS, their mail app. And it can now do things like automatically launch the Office components on an iPhone and iPad in Word, Excel, PowerPoint from within Mail. So if you're, you know, you need to view something, you need to create something. And so that brings up my question. I was hoping one of our friends would be here. We're hoping Jack Cook could join us, but he wasn't here. What's the best mobile device for Microsoft for using Microsoft Office? And in the old days, it used to be pretty clearly Windows Phone, I think. In old days would be like 2008.
Yeah, 9. For a good 2 years, it was the only way to open Office documents.
Yeah, well, that makes it best also, right? So.
Yes. I mean, it was pretty mediocre abilities, but it was the only thing that could do it.
Right, so. Without third-party, you know, workarounds and things. But now, more and more, really, if you're in a Microsoft Office environment and you want to use Mail and Office components and other things, really the iPad and an iPhone is a really, really good alternative to Windows or Microsoft's own Windows Phone.
Yeah, and this is something I wish Jack was able to make it today, because he had said something about this a few months ago when we had him on the podcast, where he said, you know, I can start a document on one device and then pick up another device and it's synced up and... Yeah. You know, he was very happy about that ability, sure. And that's a great ability, but I have that with my iOS devices and my Apple devices. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. You know, I have OneDrive on my Mac, I have OneDrive on my phone and on my iPad, and I can easily do the exact same thing. And so my thought was, is there anything that you can only do on Windows Phone that you can't do on iOS and Android? And I don't know of any.
Huh. Well, you do have a better interface on iPad than you do on Windows Phone. I mean, it's bigger.
Gosh, Todd, we're trying to go the other way. We're trying to say that something is better on Windows Phone than it is on Android or iOS.
That's a tough one. You know, the Microsoft has done an awfully good job of creating the mobile versions for iOS and for Android, for that matter.
You know, it's almost like I want to give a high five to Microsoft and go, great job getting everyone on board, guys. Sorry you cannibalized your own product.
Yeah. But, you know, really, I really do say good for them, because if their goal is to get everybody to use Microsoft Office, that's the way to do it. You don't go after the 2.5%.
Well, that's obviously what the Office group, I'm sure, was saying inside of Microsoft. And I am pretty confident that the Microsoft Office group inside of Microsoft has a bit more clout than the Windows Phone group.
Yeah, I think they make a bit more money than everybody else combined, really. Basically, it's Office, Server, and what else? What is also a moneymaker there? I'm not even sure anymore.
Windows.
Not in Windows. No, Windows is like free.
Well, it's still, it's not
for next year.
Free. Yeah. You know, it's free for the next year, but.
Yeah, free for consumers.
Yeah, free for consumers, but not for the people who are paying the most money for it anyway.
Right. Well, in any case, yeah, I should note, we spoke about it before, and I wrote about it on Extreme Tech. The Office Mobile for Windows 10 is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really weird because you need an Office 365 license to do anything reasonable with it on Windows 10. But if you have an Office 365 license and you have a, you know, X64 or X86 processor in your tablet, we're not talking Windows RT here, we're talking Windows 10. Why not just run Windows? I mean, why not just run Office since you already have a license for Office 365? There is no need for Office Mobile on a, you know, X64, X86 Windows 10 tablet.
Yeah, and that is very true and very confusing. Why they would cripple...
Ah, I see Jack.
Oh, well...
I'm going to try to plus him in here. Let us...
This will be really interesting.
Yep, Jack, are you there?
I'm there. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine, and I can see you. And just to let folks know, so Jack Cook has just joined us. Jack is a longtime friend to both John and myself, and also an expert on mobile technology. And we were just saying bad things about you in the podcast, Jack. So you joined us just in time to defend yourself. So,
I have been thinking about this all day. I cannot believe that I was late. I decided to take the dog out, and I was out too long with it. And all of a sudden,
no problem. No problem.
I think I forgot.
No problem, Jack. Neely is very important to all of us. But in any case, Jack, we were just talking about Microsoft Office integration with Outlook on the iPad and iPhone, and how much it was just improved this week with Microsoft announcing that Outlook for iOS can now launch Office, you know, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and how where Windows Phone was once the premier mobile device for using Microsoft Office, now, you know, Android and iPhone and iPad all have very decent, very good solutions from Microsoft, not, you know, some third party that may or may not do things. But and also the weird thing that Office Mobile for Windows 10 is so incredibly weak and still relies on an Office 365 license. And I was just telling John, but if you have an Office 365 license, don't install Office Mobile on your Windows tablet. Just install the full Office. It runs fine. So it's a really weird strategy.
Well, you have to remember, though, that, you know, Microsoft's position is they are a software company.
And I agree with that. John and I were just saying that's a very good thing.
And that's, I mean, that's what their primary primary purpose in life is to develop software for regardless of the platform. I mean, I'm not quite sure what their strategy is or how it'll eventually play out to make a lot of money, but I'm glad that people have all this these abilities to take and to use all of the Office products. Speaking of which, have you guys used Office Lens on your non-Windows phones?
You know, I installed it, and I think I just tried it once or twice.
I haven't had a chance to use it.
I'm telling you, for anyone out there that runs into having a huge number of contacts or people that they meet to get business cards, and keeping track of business cards can be the biggest pain in the butt. But with Office Lens, it makes life so much easier. It'll decipher a card. It'll put it in your contact list. It'll save a copy of it over in OneNote, so you have one folder that you create for business cards and has all of your business contacts. It's really amazing.
Yeah, for myself, since I'm a longtime Evernote user, I use Evernote's scannable product, which is an app very similar to Office Lens. You know, it'll deskew a business card or whiteboard or whatever it is you're doing, enhance the contrast, and then do a bit of not quite pure OCR, so it doesn't actually transform to text, but it does make it searchable. So it'll actually make handwriting even searchable in the notes. So that's what I've been using for that sort of thing.
Oh, wow. Now, are you a OneNote user?
I have not used OneNote in a long time. I've switched to Evernote many years ago.
It's funny. I like you. I did switch to Evernote, and after probably 6 months or so, I went back to OneNote, and now the way how the OneNote team has been doing for OneNote, it's just it's got to be, in my estimation, the number one product.
Well, I do have it installed on my Android and iOS devices, and of course, it's free for Windows 10 users.
Yes,
on the desktop and which it used to be a paid, you know, a very expensive paid product actually on desktop. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's something I'll take a look. In fact, that was one of the reasons I switched, Jack, because Evernote's desktop client was free, you know, and OneNote was expensive, so I had it in the office but not at home, or you know, one of those kind of things. Or I had it at home. Actually, it was the opposite. I had it at home but not in the office. Back when we were MVPs and we had, you know, that MSNDN universal subscription. Sure. So I could only use it at home, which is not where I really needed it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me that the reason I don't think I've given too much thought back to OneNote, and I have played with it. I've installed it a few times in the last couple of years and seen kind of every major new release, is that most of the internet services that were going to interface with something chose Evernote. And most of them have not built in ways to import content to OneNote. And OneNote's basic structure of replicating a notebook versus simply kind of a series of big, giant post-it notes, kind of like what Evernote looks like, mm-hmm. I think made those services a bit more obvious for that. But I do, when I talk to students and I say things like, you know, how are you taking notes electronically if they do that, I do usually recommend OneNote just because it fits more with the note-taking aspect. But it's an interesting distinction between Evernote and OneNote in terms of how they've placed themselves in the market.
Yeah, I need to take a look at it again. And I looked at it a bit more a while back when OneNote became available as part of what used to be SkyDrive, mm-hmm. you know, the Office Online stuff. Mm-hmm. But I really, because I was so invested in Evernote, I really never looked at it really hard. I think I should do that. Take another look at it and see what it can offer, since it's now on all my platforms for free, including the desktop, where, you know, it's kind of the missing link for a while.
Well, Todd, the two educators here are giving you homework. Go play with OneNote and report back.
Okay.
Well, I'm telling you that if you go to blogs, blogs .office.com/OneNote, one word, OneNote, and look at the and just look at the blog. I mean, there's a lot of information there, particularly being a retired educator. School administrators in the staff should be using this exclusively. And there's a couple of nice articles in there. So if you go there and you know check it out and. The next time we chat, I'll be interested to see if you guys have jumped on the bandwagon.
Okay. I have one thing to add since I mentioned SkyDrive and OneDrive. You know, I just got an email this morning from OneDrive that they blasted out to everybody uses it, I assume. And it says, we're emailing you because you're a member of one or more groups in OneDrive. Groups will no longer be available in OneDrive after October 16th. And all group files and info will be deleted. So it turns out I do belong to one OneDrive group, but it's not an important one. In fact, there's no files in there, so I'm not really too affected of it. But if you are a OneDrive user and use it in a group situation, assuming this email is valid and looks valid to me, you know, go take a look at your groups thing and deal with it before October 16th.
Interesting. I of course, I haven't checked my mail since this morning. Yep. I did not get that email.
Yeah. So in any case, yeah, and we're also wondering, I saw that you had posted a note on either one of the email or Facebook things that we're on, and you said you were upgrading your Venue 8 Pro to Windows 10. Did that complete?
I did. Unbelievable. First of all, what I did is I wanted to delete the partition. Mm-hmm. From it because it just didn't make any sense, and so I, it had been a long time since I've done that, and I did a quick search on the net, found a very simple way to do it. I created a backup drive. I don't know if you guys can see this, but I had to go out and get a dongle.
Yep, I've got one of those.
You know, And of course, where I am up in Maine now, the Best Buys are the less expensive places to buy $5 dongles don't exist, and I had to go downtown to the local computer store. This was $15.
Oh, wow.
It was either that or get it shipped to me and wait 4 days or 3 days for it to come. I said, I'll just do it. Well, I did it. I had to create the backup drive only because then it gives me the option to delete the petition.
Right. Which is where the restore partition is.
So I did that. I deleted the petition. I picked up, I don't know, 6 or 7 gig. And then I, of course, now I can roll back to 8. Wrong. I reformatted this and get rid of that because I'm on 10 and I'm on 10 to stay. That's
isn't
the
it great?
Well, yeah. I mean, it makes sense. Why do you want to roll back?
Yeah.
I mean, it works. Is it perfect? No. I mean, we're still beta testers. But for the most part, I mean, it really works well. It's just small things, little things that irritate me. But, you know, it's all of it will be fixed. In 6 months, this thing will be flawless.
Actually, the next major revision of it is coming out in October, so it'll be in 2 months.
Yeah. They are gonna release it. And I don't know what you guys have had for an experience yet, but these automatic updates, it just happens. It's very good.
Yeah. So a couple of things I wanted to mention. For those who've never seen a Venue 8 Pro, which is Dell's little inexpensive but very nice tablet, I have one myself, is it does not have any full-size USB ports. What Jack had to do was buy a micro USB to regular USB adapter so he could plug a standard-sized, type A USB flash drive into it to create his backup. There are, by the way, some USB flash drives that have micro USB ports, but they're kind of hard to find. I bought one a while back, and I've never seen one since in the store. The other thing I wanted to mention is that Windows 10 is really so nice that once I upgraded, and I've been running it on my Venue 8 Pro since last August or September, I guess. But once it went into production, I upgraded everything I had running Windows 8, including my Asus 10-inch tablet. And I like it so much that I've been carrying a larger, bulkier 10-inch tablet around instead of my Venue 8 Pro, because where I really despised Windows 8, I really, really like Windows 10. It really lets me do things in a much more reasonable way from the way I look at it. It takes the best of Windows 7 and the things from Windows 8 that are actually pretty nice and put them together in one thing. The only thing I don't like is the way it handles OneDrive, which is driving me bonky.
Well, no, what's happening with you there?
Well, OneDrive used to allow you to specify files to fully synchronize, folders to fully synchronize, but still have a marker for everything else. Now you can only either synchronize everything, or you can specify folder to synchronize, but if you specify folder to synchronize, you can't see everything else on your local drive. So to me, that is a step backwards. And Windows 8 could do that, by the way. So, and Windows 7 as well. Yeah.
It's interesting. On my Surface and on my Samsung Series 7 Slate, my OneDrive is set to sync everything. On the Dell, I only sync two folders, just because I wanted to have it sync.
Right. And you wanted to save space.
The size of my OneDrive folder is huge.
So, the only thing that's bothering me.
If you sync it, it then becomes part of the material on your drive.
Right. And I can't sync everything because it's bigger than the size of my...
Sure.
You know, my Venue 8, or even my Asus drive, which is 64 gigabytes.
I don't know, and I don't think you can, but I don't know if you can sync it to an SD card.
No, it considers the SD card as kind of a foreign object. You can't have, what's the word I'm looking for? You can't have smart folders on an SD card. It's kind of that sort of thing.
Well, that's, I mean, that's unfortunate. But I'll have to, after the call, I'll fire up my Dell and see. I thought there was still access. I thought you'd still have access. Yeah.
By the way, did you, you know, there's a $10 Minecraft for it, which is kind of like a mobile version. I have not paid for it or downloaded it. Did you do that, Jack?
No, I saw it was there. I'm saying, "Oh, jeez!" So I haven't even clicked on. I'm not a real game.
Yeah, I know that. That's why I asked.
Yeah, so it's not. I mean, I have two or three games on either a PC or the slate, because if I'm in a situation where I get bored and I want to do something mindless, then I'll play 2048 or. Or solitaire or something for a half an hour or 20 minutes. And I mean, that's my number one go-to game on my phone, because when I go shopping with my wife, then I sit down and I play 2048 while she's out and about.
Okay, and the last item I wanted to mention, and then John has one update to something you mentioned last week, mm-hmm. is something I found really interesting, but others have not, and that's Google's new On Hub. And actually, it's not even new; it's not out yet. So Google On Hub is their $200 Wi-Fi access point. And when I first heard about it, I said, "What the heck? Why would I need to buy a $200 Wi-Fi access point in general?" Right, and there are lots of access points, the high-end ones, that are pretty darn expensive. You know, expensive to me is anything over $30. But if you go to Costco, even you'll see, you know, Netgears and things in the $120 to $180 range. So, Wi-Fi access points in the high end are not cheap. The ones with, you know, lots of features and ability to, you know, punch holes in a firewall and all that kind of stuff. But why would I want one from Google? And fortunately, Extreme Tech let me write an article about it, so I was able to, you know, earn a few dollars for lunch to go find out more about this. And it turned out to be pretty interesting. So in addition to the, you know, normal high-end Wi-Fi access point features, you know, like it auto-adjusts frequencies and that sort of thing, it also has a Bluetooth 4. A radio, which means it can talk to low energy devices, you know, like the Fitbit that John and I were talking about before the show started, or other Bluetooth devices. It has, what is it, 802.15.4, I think, which is basically Zigbee and Thread, you know, the Internet of Things radio. And it has a speaker, just like, in fact, it looks like the Echo. It's a cylinder of sorts. And it has a speaker on the top, and it has blinking LED lights around the circle. It doesn't seem to have a microphone like the Amazon Echo, but I wonder if, you know, it'll simply use your phone as a microphone. So, you know, you can literally, you don't even have to shout to it at some point, where you can just talk to your phone, and it'll, the hub will hear you, and then boom, it will maybe answer you like the Echo. Now, at right now, by the way, the Bluetooth and what's the other one? The Zigbee radios are not turned on. So right now it doesn't do any IoT kind of stuff. It's literally just a fancy, funny looking access point. But I'm kind of curious about it. It's going to start be available or start shipping at least on August 31st. So I'm kind of wondering if it's going to be worth spending $200 on. I'm giving it some thought. I don't know. Did you hear about that, Jack? Have you thought about it?
No, I'm looking at the specs right now on it. I mean, it really isn't portable, so to speak, because it's 1.9 pounds.
No, it's not portable. It's meant to be like a piece of desk furniture. Kind of like the Echo.
It's meant to be your home router, your home access point.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
It's fine. Now, I have Comcast, and I just...
use their Xfinity Wi-Fi?
Yeah, and so I just upgraded it, so I have the 2.4 and the 5 gigahertz, and I mean, it's working really well. I changed my office in my house, and I was having trouble getting the Wi-Fi connection, so I found out about, you know, the 2.4 5 gigahertz router, and it, all of a sudden I have an amazing connection, so... that's what I'm currently doing.
But yeah. And right now, like I said, it doesn't actually do anything extra, Google said that they're going to have some other Internet of Things type products, like I think one from Asus, I don't know what it is. They'll be coming out, so apparently an On Hub is literally going to be the hub, and it'll talk to all of these IoT type devices at some point.
Well,
yeah,
I mean, that particular device does have the 2.4 and the 5 gigahertz wireless.
Yep.
So that's very cool.
Yeah, so,
I don't know if you guys have Xfinity.
No, we don't have Comcast out here.
And the sad thing is that, you know, it costs me, I think, $10 a month.
To
rent their router. You know what stake that is.
Right. Yeah, and I'm actually grateful. The cable providers, the last two I've been to, have been some of the smaller regional providers when I was in Louisiana and now Mississippi that actually tell you, go out and buy your own DOCSIS 3 modem and then have it for us to set up. They don't even try to rent equipment, which I think is much more honest to the consumer than, you know, you're going to pay this much for service, and by the way, you're going to have to pay $8.95 a month for our router, too.
Yeah. I'm on Time Warner Cable, and they give you the option. You can rent a modem from them. I think it's about $8 a month, cable modem, that is. It doesn't have Wi-Fi, by the way. Or you can turn your cable modem in, save dollars, $8 a month, and buy your own DOCSIS 3.0 cable modem.
Yeah.
So I have the option, at least. That's kind of
well.
Nice.
Actually, there is that option available with Comcast, but what I'm not sure is because I was talking to one of the reps, and they were from a different world because I could hardly understand them. I'm not sure if all of the new X1 features would come through, and I like the new X1 features that we have for our television. So
Yeah, it's understandable. Yeah. It's good to make money through confusion. You know, keep your customers confused but happy.
Confused, happy, and suck their money from their wallets.
Exactly. Okay, so I have not spent my $200 on Google Unhub. I'm still thinking about it. Maybe when more things appear from Google for their, you know, their Internet of Things strategy, which I think is called Brillo. I'm not sure why. John, you've got something you wanted to update from last week's podcast.
Yeah, so last week we did a long discussion on the different tools that educators can use going back to school. This was last year. I think we did more what students could use. This was the educator edition. Mm-hmm. And one of the tools that I mentioned was a program called ZipGrade, which allows you to use these little bubble sheets that we normally used to call just Scantron sheets and have Scantron without the Scantron machine. It's an app that runs on your smartphone. It was developed by the husband of an educator who wanted to give his wife something that she could use to do quick grading. And I used it for the first time this week with kind of a mass group of students. I had 30 students taking a pretest at the beginning of the semester. And as they were coming up, I had time. I thought, well, you know, as they start to trickle up here, I'll just start scanning them. And I did that and realized this is fast enough that as they bring them, I can scan them and then give them their scores immediately. So that was kind of fun. I could just hold the phone over it. The phone vibrated when it got a scan, and it would show the student's score right on the front. And I could say, oh, look, you got a 30% or a 50% or whatever it was, those low scores because it was a pretest. But they were, you know, very interested to know that, and they didn't have to wait until the next class period to get the data back. So.
You know, that's kind of interesting because it really alleviates the stress and tension associated, anxiety, I guess is the word I'm looking for, anxiety associated with that period between the time you take a test and you find out how well you did on it or not.
Yeah, and the other thing I really like about this software is that you can use the same bubble sheet multiple times.
Ah.
So you can set up the key to say, you know, this is for questions 1 through 10 and then another key for questions 20 through, you know, 25 or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that I can give them one sheet of paper and it'll last them most of the semester. So I can save some paper there, and that's obviously a nice thing for pragmatic and environmental reasons.
Mm.
John, if you gave a 100-question test. My memory is fading here on the use of Scantron, but I remember using it years ago. Can you scan 100 questions if you have to turn it over?
You can. There are Scantrons that'll do, I think, both sides either all at once or in just one stack and then another stack. It depends on the machine because Scantron has different levels of the machines that they sell.
No, I meant on that app.
They make they have a Creative Commons license 20 question sheet, 50 question sheet, and 100 question sheet. So you can do 100 questions in one scan.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Wow. If you think of that, John, can you send me an email on that? I want to send it to my old school.
Yeah, I will. I will send you a message. The service is, I think, $7 a year for unlimited scans. Wow. So it's definitely something edgy. And it's also, it syncs up with cloud storage. It supports student ID numbers and different classes that you can create the records online for. So it's a really nice, robust system for $7 a year.
Absolutely. Well, if you know, the number of people out there that are listening to this podcast that are teachers that use Scantron, I'm sure that when they all have it comes to test day, they have to wait in line to use the one machine that the school has.
Well, and yeah, I'm thankful. I'm actually, my psychology department sits in a college of education for some weird reason. That's where we ended up in this university. So our Scantron machine is on this floor, and it's usually easy to get around to. It's just the pain of having to go down there and get it, and then I don't think it actually prints out the reports or anything like that. You have to kind of, if you want to know item analysis and all that, you would have to compute that by hand, and ZipGrade does that all automatically.
Very cool.
Very cool. Hey, Jack, you have anything you wanted to add? Any topic or something you've tried lately that you want to tell folks about?
Just for those folks that haven't made the jump yet, Windows 10 is really worth it.
Yeah.
I was an absolute believer in Windows 8, unlike a lot of people. They just couldn't.
Yeah, that was me. Couldn't use it.
they couldn't accept the change. And I really got into Windows 8, and it was just, I mean, it was wonderful, particularly with a tablet. And now Windows 10 has the best of both worlds. I mean, it's just really slick. In fact, I had a fellow over last night for supper, and I was giving him a quick demo, and because he wasn't going to change from Windows 7 to Windows 10, and he said, "You know, maybe I'm going to do this." It's really, really good.
Yeah, it's. I would say it's not only better Windows 8; it's better Windows 7. It's a very nice environment, and you know, you did not hear me saying things like that about Windows 8 at all. Most of my statements on Windows 8 were prefaced by words we can't utter on a G-rated show.
I think what's impressing me an awful lot is the they're replying to people in the forums that are having issues. They're making a concerted effort to take and to deal with issues that have, you know, that are occurring to, say, for example, five or ten or more people right away. It's a real positive feeling to see how well they're addressing this.
Before we close the podcast, there is still one other grump I have about Windows 10. It's the mail app just doesn't work for me.
Oh,
I've got it on three machines and it doesn't work on any of them.
What? No, so it doesn't work at all.
It will launch and it'll crash.
Oh wow! I heard that the other day. Someone else is having that. Fortunately, it's working on all three of mine.
Yeah, I can't figure it out.
Although one account isn't synced. It's an IMAP account. Yeah. It has problems.
When I start deleting, you know, like spam or whatever, it just crashes.
Really?
Yep. Yep. On all machines. Well, two are, you know, tablets, and one is a full i5, Core i5 notebook.
Yeah. Well, have you addressed that in the forums at all?
You know, I haven't. I've reported it on the feedback, the Windows Insider feedback, but nothing so far. Yep. Wow. Okay, well, I know John has to go, so I'm going to stop the podcast. Wanted to thank Jack Cook for dropping by. Maybe we can have him on again sometime, and we will talk to you later.